D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch. Heute A Japan That Cannot Say Sorry von Franziska Serafim. In unserer Reihe Translating Atonement, Can Countries Learn From Each Other aus dem Einstein-Forum, haben wir heute eine Kennerin japanischer Geschichte zu Gast. Franziska Serafim lehrt als Professorin für Geschichte am Boston College. Sie hat zahlreiche Artikel auch in deutschen Medien über Erinnerung und Kriegsverbrechen verfasst. Ihr Hauptwerk trägt den Titel War Memory and Social Politics in Japan, das 2006 erschienen ist. Ihren nun folgenden Vortrag hat sie am 4. Juni dieses Jahres in Potsdam gehalten. Auf der Tagung ging es um die Frage, inwieweit Staaten von anderen profitieren können, wenn auf deren Territorium Verbrechen begangen worden sind.
I took the challenge of models, literally, so I'm going to talk about models. That's going to be my lens. There's much more to be said, obviously, but the kind of modeling or the claim that Germany ought to serve as some sort of model for Japan is actually a big part of the 80s and 90s memory culture. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and in somewhat ahistorical fashion will proceed from the present and then selectively look to the past to bring you some historical roots or some tidbits that are necessary to understand the 80s and 90s, rather than telling you sort of a lineal story. So please bear with me and be prepared to hop around in time a little bit. In July 1995, as Japan was gearing up for the 50th anniversary of the end of the Asia-Pacific War, The Economist published an article entitled The Japan That Cannot Say Sorry. At the time, many people in America, especially in Japan certainly, would have understood the reference to a book that had been published a few years earlier in Japan and immediately translated into English by Akira Morita, the Sony chairman, and Ishihara Shintaro, who is now actually Tokyo's infamous right-wing mayor. That book was entitled The Japan That Can Say No. So that's the reference to that title. Of course, that referred to the 80s trade wars between Japan and the U.S. And it was sort of seen as a nationalist track, kind of an arrogant way of saying, you know what, Japan can come out from under that kind of subordinate position to the U.S. and irked the American public not insignificantly. Now, the article itself, the Economist article in the summer of 95, really was a comment on the diet resolution controversy at the time. At the time, the Japanese parliament was trying to come up with an official apology statement that all lawmakers could agree upon and was supposed to serve as Japan's first sort of official statement geared towards Asia, not to the U.S. in particular. And it was really a mess. I mean, it was sad to observe that scene of how they ripped this apart and could not agree on anything. Murayama Tomiichi, who was then the prime minister and the first socialist prime minister since 1948, that's an important part, that Japan's post-war history really has been dominated by one party being in power, the Conservative Party. So this first socialist prime minister, for him it was a personal quest to issue an unequivocal apology to Japan's Asian neighbors. And he ran into massive opposition by lawmakers beholden to special interests. This, in some ways, is not unlike the Enola Gay controversy in America at the same time. The Enola Gay exhibit at the Smithsonian, which was supposed to show the fuselage of the plane that dropped the atomic bombs, within the context of a larger historical context, and also to show what kind of damage this did. And special interests in the U.S., especially veterans organizations, made that all but impossible. It was a big mess. But in many ways, actually quite similar to what was going on in Japan. Now, on August 15 that year itself, there were the usual ceremonies remembering the war dead. No cabinet minister went to Yasukuni Shrine. That actually is something that was revived a few years later, very much as a response to kind of the left challenge of the early 90s. But more interesting actually than that was an evening ETV coverage, that's an educational channel on TV, of civic groups who had invited Richard von Weizsäcker to come to Japan on that day and discuss the question of how Germany had dealt with these issues in a way that obviously did not put Germany into the same dilemmas at the 50th anniversary than obviously was the case in Japan. Now, The Economist article represents in some ways or typifies a whole genre of public media articles in the American or largely the Western press that declared Japan somehow at odds with the global civilizational morality for which Germany tended to serve as the norm, even though its historical experience might better be seen as exceptional. And it runs a little bit like this. Japan, still nationalistic after all these years, wants to protect its cultural heritage and therefore finds it difficult to apologize for its war conduct. I think this is more or less literally what it said. And I always thought, God, you substitute the U.S. for Japan, and it's more or less the same. I mean, the U.S. has never found it opportune to apologize for its war conduct in Asia. But the important part is, it's always culture. It's never politics. So these cultural explanations diagnosed a pathology that no one had cared to look at before. I mean, for decades, this was never a topic. But that connected all too well with age-old Orientalist clichés about backwardness, groupism, and what Ruth Benedict called Japan's shame culture versus Germany's guilt culture. Actually, much closer to the truth is not groupism, but the opposite, fragmentation and political uses of different kinds of memories that conflict in major ways and are politically instrumentalized. Disturbingly to me, when I got to Berlin almost a week ago, I read a Zeit article last week entitled Fukushima schon vergessen, Fukushima already forgotten, which claims that the Japanese, in the interest of social harmony, have already stopped investigating TEPCO's responsibility for the nuclear disaster in March, just as they never dealt with their responsibility for the war. And as always, the same person gets quoted, the famous political scientist Maruyama Masao, who in 1946 wrote an influential article entitled The System of Irresponsibility, in which he compared Japan's wartime political system that he characterizes as a system of irresponsibility where the buck is constantly passed. It never stops anywhere, really, in contrast to Germany's Nazi system, where you had Hitler, where you had people, you know, on whom you could really blame certain things. He then went on, actually, to study Karl Jaspers, Die Schuldfrage, and concluded that this particular approach to responsibility or to war guilt, four-part division that Jaspers introduces here, actually makes little sense for Japan because of this system of irresponsibility. So this is a wonderful tool because the Japanese, of course, came up with this to use to make that kind of claim. Now, I wish to dwell today not so much on the specifics of Japan's own particular war memory, but rather the issue of modeling. I've written extensively on this war culture, so please ask questions. I'd be happy to elaborate on that. So I seek to highlight from a historical perspective the political uses of the German atonement model, or more generally, the uses of comparisons in an intercultural context for which Japan and Germany have come to represent an important example. But I think it is also just as important to look at this in the context of Rwanda, of Cambodia, even Lebanon perhaps. That intercultural part, I think, has not gotten specific attention in our conversations yet, but I'd like to raise that here. After all, Elazar Barkan's new international morality, or the urge to translate atonement, as Misha puts it, dates not much further back than the end of the 20th century and seems to be tied up with the renegotiation of international relations and the meaning of world regionalism in the age of globalization that began roughly with the end of the Cold War. So there's a clear link there, but I don't think the Cold War explains everything, as it was this invisible hand that sort of directed things. But no matter how new, this global sensibility all too easily tapped into old assumptions and stereotypes, at least rhetorically, as I have already suggested. But I think we need to think with that. You can't quite separate it from those kind of rhetorical issues. I ask several fairly basic questions of the issue of models. One, who is invested in this? This is a question of agency. And this is in many ways my main organizing strategy today. Second, for what purposes do models get used? That's a question of interests, of political interests more than of morality. I recognize there's a religious issue, there are philosophical issues, there are moral issues, ethical issues, but I'm fundamentally interested in politics. I think it's in Asia this is particularly important. Third, when and how does this become meaningful? This is a question of historical context, of historical contingency. And because of that, I'm against models. As a historian, I don't believe in models. I believe in historical contingency, right? You know, this becomes a really important part of it. And last, as I already mentioned, which rhetorical or historiographical patterns are mobilized for this? And that's why I need to go back into the past and selectively bring in a few points to make that. So this, you know, this issue of historiographical patterns too brings in the talk of belatedness that always enters this Japan-Germany comparison, or what Carol Gluck has called the chronopolitics of memory, by which she means that there is a certain history of memory that is politically determined and that was very different in Japan's case than in Germany's case. The kinds of breaks that we accustomed to in the 1960s in Germany didn't happen in Japan at that time. In many ways, the Japanese were not silent at all, right, immediately after the war. But that's when they talked the most, when the Germans were silent. I don't believe the silence issue, but in any case, it's simple for now. So there is a reverse chronology in some ways that we need to deal with. This is an issue of intersecting memory dynamics, or what Sebastian Conrad and others have called entangled memories. The past that needs atoning may be a shared past, that of the Asia-Pacific War, but the production of memories depend on asymmetrical relations and interactions, as well as on a plethora of different and often conflicting interests in the present. In my talk today, I focus on the ways in which the German model has been invoked and instrumentalized in the United States, that's the first part, in Japan, that's the second, and then briefly in China and South Korea as the third, working from the present backwards. What emerges is a pattern in which the Japanese government consistently pushed the issue of war responsibility back into civil society. It was always present in a backhanded sort of way, but never in a direct way, until very recently. Atonement became a local issue more than anything, often well organized. So this is not just private little things, but rather well organized. And also that of private memories that became public through the tremendous prestige of self-history writing, of testaments, of testimonies that have been published in Japan since the late 1940s, from the far right to the far left. And Alaida, I brought the book that you were interested in. I will talk about this a little later. It's hot off the press. Peter Buchholz is Vom Teufel zu Menschen, die Geschichte der China-Heimkehrer in Selbstzeugnissen. This is a translation and interpretation of testimonies by Japanese war criminals who were kept in Chinese in prisons and returned to Japan in 1956 convicted and never took back a word of their self-confessions of guilt and their understanding of Japan's war as an aggressive war, and became a formidable group in the Japanese war memory culture, something that we never hear about, but that's actually fairly formidable there. There's no question here that Japanese efforts to responsibly address various war legacies, including war atrocities, remain highly insufficient and deeply problematic. No question about this. I'm not zooming in on that. I'm not going through these various atrocities and talking about how they have been remembered or not. I just wanted to make sure that that's understood. So the first part here is on the Japan-German comparison in the U.S. And the idea here is to not only organize this around agency, but also around particular historical and political contexts in which this kind of modeling issue assumes different meanings and different purposes. Of course, there's a long tradition among American historians and the American public as well in understanding Japan in light of Germany. And this has many reasons into which I don't want to go, but just as a few examples, 19th century nation building, for example, has always been seen as a kind of modeling after imperial Germany in terms of institutions, in terms of the constitution, and so on. Interpreted as a kind of catch up with the West, mentality that characterized Japan as a latecomer to modernity, similar to Germany. There's a whole host of literature on that. But then also the 1940s, for example, American war propaganda imagined Japan as the little sick patient of Hitler or his puppet. If you look at Dr. Seuss's cartoons of the war, Dr. Seuss is usually known to Americans as the writer of children's books, but actually he was a major cartoonist, political cartoonist during the war. And it's fascinating the way that he drew Hitler and Tojo, or Hitler and the Japanese, alley cats everywhere. Or monkeys, always a huge number of them, faceless, although Tojo did have a face. And the way that this relationship was pictorially understood is deeply revealing and very entertaining as well. Ruth Benedict's anthropological study then of the Japanese that she came out in 46 then with this shame culture versus guilt culture, or the 1960s American modernization theory that was instrumental in explaining Japanese modern history in terms of a kind of copy mechanism, particularly of German institutions and thought.
Im Hörsaal auf D Radio Wissen verfolgen Sie diesmal A Japan That Cannot Say Sorry von Franziska Serafim. Wir setzen Ihre Rede nach einer kleinen Unterbrechung fort.
D Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Throughout the 1990s, the idea of Germany serving as a model to Japan's coming to terms with its wartime past was of a particular American vintage. Both in academic and popular writings, a familial litany of official memory, that is, apologies, restitution payments, textbooks reforms, memorials. This is sort of the usual litany in which Japan and Germany are compared, and Japan just is lacking on every front. And Yasukuni Shrine, it's a private memorial, actually, that goes back to the Meiji period, where the souls of Japanese war soldiers are enshrined, is always sort of the central issue. Nobody ever mentions that it's an entirely private institution. Anybody can go there and think whatever they want to think. The issue is when a government representative goes and uses government funds to worship there, then the whole thing becomes complicated and has been highly, highly controversial in Japan since the 1950s. But what I'd like to stress in terms of the 1990s is that there was a genuine element of discovery that propelled this discourse. Nanjing, sex slaves, grisly human experiments in the development of biological warfare? Who knew? There's a particular Eurocentrism to not knowing about Japan. Never mind that the Allies had convicted and executed the man who bore the ultimate responsibility for the Nanjing massacre in China in 1937 at the Tokyo War Crimes Trial, because Tokyo was also forgotten. Nuremberg, everybody knows. Tokyo is the poor cousin. This kind of unevenness is always sort of justified by saying, oh, but that trial really was a sham and it really didn't work and didn't do anything for us. Turns out to actually have been a very productive trial and is now increasingly more cited when we talk about the International War Crimes Tribunal. More disturbingly, the crimes of Unit 731, that's a biological and chemical warfare unit in Manchuria, had not been forgotten, but literally covered up by the American military in 1945, who willy-nilly bought up all the evidence and data from the Japanese for its own biological warfare program in exchange for letting Colonel Ishii and his men vanish with a new identity. So this whole one of Japan's worst crimes, one might say, during the war, was entirely covered up by the U.S. for political and military interests. That comes out in the late 80s and 90s and is newly discovered as this new thing. And then, of course, as most of you know, Iris Chang exemplified this kind of discovery thing with her book on Nanjing that she subtitled The Forgotten Holocaust. I don't think I need to explain anymore. Largely based on the discovery of the diary of John Rabe, the good Nazi. It's wonderful to also now have a German who is responsible for having documented this massacre and actually helped save a good number of Chinese. So she really instrumentalizes. I sometimes get calls from German TV stations who want to, you know, do something on John Rabe again, and then I'm supposed to comment, and I'm so sick of it. The only way in which this becomes news in Germany is when there's a good German involved, you know, not for the history itself. So they didn't call me back. After all, I was too irreverent here. But in the U.S., these so-called discoveries of Japanese culpability did wonders for the identities of the Asian American communities. And we should not neglect that domestic political angle in the U.S. And much can be said about that in the early post-war period. But in the 1990s, the Chinese rallied around the victimhood of Nanjing. The Koreans embraced the comfort women issues as if they had been raped only yesterday, all of them collectively. And it gave them a particular edge vis-a-vis other Asian American communities in the U.S. I'm a little irreverent towards this kind of history, although I'm not denigrating it. In many ways, it did great things in the sense that it brought this kind of history into the public consciousness much, much more. But it's very interesting to look at the politics of using these kinds of the Japanese war crimes and the second victimhood, meaning we've been raped once during the war, and then we've been neglected as victims for decades afterwards, the kind of Giordani, Zweite Schuld kind of argument. So this actually played a huge role in U.S. politics. Almost entirely absent in all of these stories about the amnesiatic Japanese was the fact that the U.S. critically shaped Japan's memory culture as a whole, not only by shielding the emperor from accusations of war responsibility, but more importantly, by structuring the U.S.-Japan alliance in a way that permanently subordinated Japan's foreign policy to the strategic interests of the U.S., which meant keeping Japan out of Asia. And it wasn't just the Cold War that did that. Somebody made Cold War policies, and they were made along those lines, denying it the regional integration that Germany was allowed to achieve in Western Europe. I cannot stress enough how important this is, and I could spend the remainder of the talk just discussing how important that part is, and also how important the division of Germany and the non-division of Japan, so to speak, was in bringing this contrast to bear on this contrast. So it gives you a little bit of a sense of what's happening in the U.S. for particular reasons there. Now, the German model in Japan, I'm kind of excluding Germany because in some ways, until recently, Germany didn't compare itself to anybody else. Singularity was really important, and certainly not to the Japanese, halfway around the other globe, or as somebody on a Manhattan subway told me once, you study Japanese history, you might as well study the history of the moon. We don't know anything about that either. So the German model in Japan. The idea of German Vergangenheitsbewältigung as a model against which Japan simply doesn't measure up was actually not primarily an American, but actually a Japanese invention, and it came out of not the 1990s, but the 1980s. It was, in fact, a shrewd political move by the progressive left, so-called, you know, the progressive public intellectuals, and a host of civic political activists, well-organized since the early post-war, who had long been deeply involved in what in Japan is called the war responsibility debate, Senso Sekininron. It's not guilt, it's always war responsibility, that's what it is. And it's for the war much more so than for colonialism and so on. This scene of talking about war responsibility had exploded on the public scene in 1946 and had waxed and waned periodically throughout the post-war It was well organized in left liberal circles. It moved into permanent opposition in the early 1950s. That has much to do with the U.S.-Japan relationship, and remained there precisely with the help of the U.S. that backed the conservative government in particular ways. This is a complicated history that I'm just mentioning, not going into. These people were always visible, but they were intellectually tied to Marxism, at least until the 60s, 70s, Marxist thought, and politically to the socialist opposition. And they remained in the opposition. They never made it into the political mainstream, but that doesn't mean that they were not publicly present. They were, in fact, very present. But, you know, it was oppositional discourse, and in the sense that the country really, you know, moved towards economic development, this had a particular place, and it did not move into, it wasn't brought together with these other aspects. Art actually flourished, oppositional art. I mean, the whole, this is something we're discovering now. It's unbelievable what kind of art projects about atonement were produced in Japan in the 50s and 60s. A new film documentary was just made by Linda Hoglund. It just screened at Harvard. It's absolutely stunning. And nobody knew, me included. So it's another discovery here. But in one of these things that simply don't make it across the Pacific and don't get public attention. Now, in the 1990s, the political landscape really started to change. The 1955 system, this long dominance of the LDP, began to break up. Greater ties to Asia came forth. The economic balance of power in Asia shifted greatly as China and Korea were rising, and Japan's economy, of course, in the early 90s, you know, was on a dive down. So there were a lot of contextual changes and shifts there. The emperor died in 89 and so on, that contributed to shifts in Japan's memory culture. And the shift that I'm talking about is that a very lively memory culture that had always existed had existed as a fiercely domestic culture, whereas now the ties to particularly Asia, but globally, on not a state level, but really on a civic activism level and civil group level, that's what really took off in the 80s and 90s, and it made all the difference. A whole sort of chronology throughout the 80s can be looked at. In 1982, the textbook issue with controversy with China and Korea. 1985, when Nakasone, the prime minister, goes to Yasukuni Shrine in the first demonstrative move. This was actually not a routine for Japanese prime ministers to worship at Yasukuni right at the same time as Richard von Weizsäcker, of course, talked about atonement. This was a huge contrast that was immediately utilized. His speech was immediately translated, went into 29 editions in the following 12 years. And in the early 90s, you had the making of a new term in Japanese, kako no kokufuku, or vergangenheitsbewältigung, crude translation. Actually, Sühne, Versöhnung, all of those terminologies in German never really made much of an impact in Japan. This was the first time that the terminology was really translated here, and very much for political purposes. It didn't really do anything. But this is really, the German example here really becomes ammunition for a committed, progressive left of responsible intellectuals and activists, really, to bring this out into the open and to pressure the government to do something about this. All of these issues that happen in the 80s, they always look to us as if the Chinese finally, you know, told the Japanese to get with it. Every single one of these things originated in Japan by Japanese activists, and it was the Chinese that then came in and used it for their own purposes, but they did it on a state level, and therefore it became visible internationally. So the contextual change of the 1980s is very important. Let me say a few things about the Germany model in China and South Korea. It takes two to tangle, as we know, and the political uses of war memory and efforts at reconciliation in Japan's closest neighbors and primary victims of its wartime imperialism, Communist China mainly, and South Korea, is critical to this story. China's economic rise and partial liberalization under Deng Xiaoping, and most importantly, the democratization movement from below in South Korea, opened up a source of energy that had not been available earlier. Not that there hadn't been reconciliation efforts before. Both China and Korea said no to their claims of reparations earlier, But what really happens in the 1980s is that civic groups in Japan make common cause with civic groups in China and especially in South Korea. And it's that moment, those transnational contacts, not on the governmental level, but on the civic level, that propels this issue into the public sphere. And the comfort women issue is particularly important here. Were it not for Korean, South Korean feminist movements that for the first time were able to really surface in the late 1980s, none of this would have happened, perhaps. But all these lawsuits happened in Japanese courts. It was Japanese lawyers who were at the forefront of all of this. So it's not something that entirely came from the outside, but rather through links with other countries. Of course, both the Chinese and the South Korean governments quickly zoomed in on this Japan-Germany comparison to demonstrate its double victimization and to just discover how politically useful and for its own political strategies this was in redefining Asian relations at that time. So it became a state-centered narrative in these countries as well, different in China and Korea, interestingly, because the Koreans also really discovered in Korea, the issue of war memory has much to do with its own division, similar to Germany. And it's really being anti-Japanese is perhaps the one thing that both North and South Korea can agree upon. But the South Koreans coming to terms with the human rights violations of its own authoritarian regime made a huge difference in coming closer to Japan. China has dealt with this quite differently. There's a huge academic interest now in China that wants to understand Japan-China relations and the issue of reconciliation that has not worked by looking to the German-French and German-Polish relations. So this is very much a realpolitik one. Let me conclude very quickly by just suggesting that the end of this arc might be the 2000 Women's International Military Tribunal that took place in Tokyo, I don't know if you've heard of this, in which this is entirely non-state, non-official. Civic groups from everywhere in Asia came together to look at precisely the kinds of crimes that the Tokyo War Crimes Trial had avoided, the emperor and the sex slavery part. And who was invited? People from Rwanda, people from South Africa, people from Latin America, people from Europe and America to come together, not as a model, but as collectively addressing something on a non-official level that had not been part of this discourse. Thank you.
A Japan That Cannot Say Sorry von Franziska Serafim. Wir sendeten eine Rede der Expertin aus dem Einstein-Forum Potsdam. Aufzeichnung war am 4. Juni 2011 unter dem Titel Translating Atonement, Can Countries Learn from Each Other?
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.